You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
And not everything I'm going to talk about today is illegal, but everything that I'm going to talk about today is bad for regular Americans.
Now, the Maggie Dawn Show continues.
I'm a geek. I'm a nerd. I'm a data wonk.
From Congress and courts to burgers and baseball.
I talk about food a lot on the show. It's a thing. I am a foodie.
Once again, here's lawyer and economist Maggie Dawn.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're rejoining us. My name's Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, it's a very busy day of weather across the state of Wisconsin. I'm coming to you in southeastern Wisconsin from WAUK 540 AM 101.1 FM. We have yet to get the brunt of the weather systems moving through, but I'm very happy to be joined from Severe Weather Studios by Corey Hartman to give an update on the rest of the state and the golf ball size, pea size, I don't know, maybe even bigger size hail that's coming down. We've got some tornado action. Corey, tell the listeners about it.
Hey, Maggie. Yeah, we've been putting the Civic Media Radio Network in full business here this afternoon. We've had reports of, as you said, anywhere from pea to golf ball size hail, all the way from the Madison area, all the way back to Eau Claire. Multiple tornado reports were happening back into portions of western Minnesota near the Roberts area, near the Baldwin area, and those did touch down. We had confirmations of those. We did have a brief touchdown in the Portage area just about 20 minutes ago. We actually caught that on a couple of our Storm Chaser live feeds, and that happened as well. So we've really had kind of all of it going on, and there is a tornado watch that remains in effect for pretty much the entire state of Wisconsin except for the far northeastern counties.
So that means, is there a tornado watch as well here in southeastern Wisconsin?
Yes, it's the entire state except for the far northeast. Yep. So we've got, the threat, the possibility of all of the ingredients coming together for tornadoes. In fact, a severe thunderstorm warning just issued for the Waukesha area. That's for Waukesha and Washington counties until 5:45. That's for some quarter-size hail and 60-mile-per-hour winds. But that particular storm is all by itself heading toward Waukesha. We don't like when the storms are all by themselves because they have the potential to use all of those ingredients and possibly turn more severe. So we're keeping our eye on the radar closely here this evening.
Same question that I asked Mace at the top of the show, Corey. Anyone in the state right now that needs to take shelter immediately or be on the lookout for warnings to take shelter as you understand things?
Yeah, absolutely. So northeast of Portage, north of Partyville, near Dalton right now, there's strong indication of rotation. And again, that was where we had the confirmed couple of touchdowns was right in Portage about 15 minutes ago. So further north and east of there, Dalton, Kingston, that's where we've got the potential for tornadoes. Also near Adams right now, Adams Friendship, there's a possible tornado there. And a confirmed tornado is a little bit further to the north and west near Abbotsford, Wisconsin, west of Marshfield near Loyal, the potential of a tornado there. So there's actually three locations right now along this line that could see a tornado, and a tornado did touch down near Neillsville, Wisconsin about 20 minutes ago.
Well, Corey, please do keep us updated. Folks, that's Corey Hartman from Severe Weather Studios. Thank you for keeping us safe. And stay tuned here, ladies and gentlemen, to the Civic Media Radio Network. We will, of course, on this program, continue to be bringing you breaking weather news so that you and your families can stay safe. Corey, thanks again. You stay safe out there, my friend.
You bet. And we do break in individual stations as conditions warrant in each market. So
Thank you, Corey. So again, as individual conditions warrant within each market, no matter what station you are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network on, we will keep you apprised of what's going on in your neck of the woods so that you and your families can stay safe. Again, thank you, Corey. With that weather update now completed, I've got to take you all to the Supreme Court arguments that occurred this morning. Let's set the stage. Of course, as you well know, as your legal eagle here on the airwaves, I spent my morning listening to the Supreme Court arguments so that you don't have to. They can be a little bit dry and technocratic, but here's the gist of things. Recall, if you will, that Donald Trump, on his first day after getting inaugurated, signed an executive order purporting to get rid of birthright citizenship. Birthright citizenship meaning this: if you are born in this country, you are a citizen. It doesn't matter if your mother or your father are here illegally or only on temporary protected status. If you are born here, you are a citizen. This has been the legal interpretation under the Supreme Court for 127 years. The initial decision related to a Chinese American who was not permitted to exit a ship after visiting China. He was a born here American citizen. He was forced to stay on this ship. It resulted in a Supreme Court case 127 years ago. Since then, three subsequent Supreme Court cases have upheld birthright citizenship. But the Trump administration says that it can do away with this with the stroke of a pen by fiat. So this is the case. There are a number of cases in various federal district courts challenging the Trump administration's executive order. Now, what's fascinating about this case is that some of these district courts, these are the trial courts within the federal court system, have issued what purport to be injunctions that prevent the Trump administration from implementing this executive order anywhere, meaning beyond the jurisdiction of that district court. For example, there are two district courts in the state of Wisconsin, the Eastern District and the Western District. Judge Dugan's criminal case is proceeding in the Eastern District, for example. So what an injunction in some of these cases where judges have found the president's executive order to be unconstitutional have said is that even if, for example, the court found that, made that conclusion, reached that judgment in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, it would apply in the Western District and perhaps across the United States. So the Trump administration has not brought forward an immediate challenge to the underlying district court rulings, which have been unanimous that what the president has tried to do is unconstitutional. No, what they've asked the Supreme Court to hear on an emergency basis is whether or not a district court can enter an injunction that applies across the country. So they're making this technical procedural argument instead of getting about the business of just arguing about whether or not this thing is illegal. Now, take a pause here, ladies and gentlemen, and think about the implications. If a district court cannot proclaim or conclude that what an administration, what a particular president is trying to do is unconstitutional, and prohibit the administration from enforcing that decision, that policy, here that executive order nationwide, what constitutional harms, what irreparable harms may occur to individuals that don't happen to be covered by that particular individual district court's initial ruling? The potential for grave harm to people in this case is quite unique, quite extraordinary. And indeed, the unanimity with which the district courts have ruled, always against the administration, always concluding that what they're trying to do is unconstitutional, in the face of 127 years of Supreme Court precedent, in the face of every single presidential administration over those 127 years abiding by those rulings, why then is it even a facially reasonable argument for the Trump administration to say, well, a district court can't tell us that we can't enforce this it's been unconstitutional for 127 years, and all courts that have ever heard this question in that period of time have ruled that birthright citizenship is a thing. Well, we want to just declare this newborn to be not a citizen in this other district. What chaos would ensue? What unfairness? That's what was before the Supreme Court today. Now, there's a lot of technicalities moving around here, but I wanted to give and share with you some of what I consider to be the aha moments in these arguments. What you're going to hear first is from Justice Sonia Sotomayor. And Jacob, this is going to be cut 23. Cut 23.
So when a new president orders that, because there's so much gun violence going on in the country, and he comes in and he says, I have the right to take away the guns from everyone, then people, and he sends out the military to seize everyone's guns. We and the courts have to sit back and wait until every named plaintiff gets, or every plaintiff whose gun is taken comes into court.
Consider that. Now, in that quote, we didn't have the answer from the government's lawyer, but what he said in response to that question from Justice Sotomayor was, yes, that's what we're saying. So I've gotten a couple of texts while we've been on the air from some of our conservative friends saying, why do these liberals always just want to violate the law and do all those things? Here, respectfully, it is the Trump administration that has been found by both Republican and democratically appointed judges to be violating the law. And if you don't really care about birthright citizenship, then, as Justice Sotomayor is pointing out, maybe you care about the Second Amendment. So what if a president issued an executive order that said you no longer have a Second Amendment right to bear arms? And as the justice pointed out, I'm dispatching the U.S. military and any other U.S. law enforcement to seize weapons of every single American citizen from coast to coast. If what the Trump administration is arguing in the birthright citizenship case today in the Supreme Court is accurate, then each and every gun owner in America potentially would need to bring an individual action to prevent the federal government from seizing their weapons, even though that order would be so facially unconstitutional as to beggar any argument to the contrary. So if that's bothersome to you as a conservative, then you should be equally bothered by this idea that the Trump administration is arguing today in the Supreme Court that each individual, newborn's parent, has to argue before a court, has to avail themselves of legal process, has to have the money, the means, the knowledge to retain a lawyer to argue about these things. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not the way our Constitution was ever conceived of to operate. Now, there are legitimate problems with these sort of broad injunctions that some district courts have been entering. And we've seesawed back and forth. During the first Trump administration, a lot of lawsuits were brought challenging Trump administration actions in the Ninth Circuit because it's considered to be more liberally leaning. During the Biden administration, a lot of lawsuits were brought in districts in Texas in the Fifth Circuit because it's considered to be more conservative. But I offer to you this. Is this really how our rights are supposed to be defined? One individual, one case, one district court at a time? And if so, then what remains of our Constitution except perhaps a statement of principles, of hopes that you will need to spend your money to vindicate every time the federal government violates your fundamental rights? I'm Maggie Dawn. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, lucky for you, I just so happen to be a lawyer, which is highly relevant for today's conversation. This morning, the Supreme Court heard arguments from the Trump administration challenging the ability of U.S. federal district courts to enter injunctions prohibiting the Trump administration from enforcing a patently, facially unconstitutional executive order nationwide. That's the particular procedural posture of this case. My argument, what I offer to you this afternoon, is that's just stupid. Now, perhaps in the past, when presidential administrations didn't actively do, purposefully so, things that are facially unconstitutional, limiting the reach of a district court's injunction might make sense. You know, when the government actually operated in good faith. We don't have that today. And so the question is, if the Supreme Court rules that every single federal district court and potentially every single individual impacted by the federal government's patently unconstitutional action has to bring their own lawsuit or seek class certification, which can maybe get there eventually, what happens in the meanwhile as the federal government denies rights to individuals in direct contravention of our Constitution? Imagine, if you will, if it was your right to bear arms, would you be satisfied in having to bring each case individually or waiting for a federal court to go through the lengthy process of determining whether or not a class action was appropriate? If the federal government were coming to take your guns, I would suggest many of the people who are defending the Trump administration today would take to the streets and demand the courts do something. Let's take a listen. This is Justice Kagan in an exchange with the Trump administration's lawyer this morning. This is Cut 26.
I'm just going to ask to, you to put yourself in a different frame of mind. Hard to do. Assume something you won't want to assume. But the assumption that I want you to make is that on the merits, which of course you did not take to this court, on the merits, you are wrong, that the EO is unlawful. And I want to ask you, if we assume that, how do we get to that result on your view of the rules?
It is very difficult for me to attempt the hypothetical, but I will.
You know, I think that that's the important question in this case. Let's just assume you're dead wrong. How do we get to that result? Does every single person that is affected by this EO have to bring their own suit? Are there alternatives? How long does it take? How do we get to the result that there is a single rule of citizenship that is not, that is the rule that we've historically applied rather than the rule that the EO would have us do?
Rule 23 would be one natural path, assuming that a class could be certified, which we might dispute in this particular case.
Well, you might dispute it. And, you know, I mean, I think the question is there a class that's just all children of people who have entered illegally? You know, is that an appropriate class? Can the same thing be done under Rule 23? Or are you going to tell me that, no, Rule 23 has lots of requirements and you'll never be able to certify a class like that?
Rule 23 provides the equitable tools subject to rigorous criteria, appropriately rigorous criteria, to obtain that kind of class-wide and
emergency. That suggests to me you're going to be standing up here in the next case saying that Rule 23 is inapt for this circumstance with this number of people, maybe with some questions that are individual, who knows. So let's put Rule 23 aside, because I got to tell you, that does not fill me with great confidence. How else are we going to get to the right result here, which is on my assumption that the EO is illegal?
What you heard there about Rule 23 is that he's saying you have to go the class action route. And what Justice Kagan is responding with, well, that takes a whole lot of time. So what happens to the people whose rights are being violated while all of that sorts out? Why isn't a nationwide injunction the appropriate pathway to protect constitutional rights? Now, all of this begs a bigger question, which is, presidents aren't kings. So what then? Let's take cut 30. This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Let me just turn your attention to one other thing, because the real concern, I think, is that your argument seems to turn our justice system, in my view at least, into a catch-me-if-you-can kind of regime from the standpoint of the executive, where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit in order for the government to stop violating people's rights. Justice Kagan says, let's assume for the purpose of this that you're wrong about the merits, that the government is not allowed to do this under the Constitution, and yet it seems to me that your argument says we get to keep on doing it until everyone who is potentially harmed by it figures out how to file a lawsuit, hire a lawyer, et cetera. And I don't understand how that is remotely consistent with the rule of law. You know, a system, and I appreciate that you go back to English common law and the Chancery Court, but they had a different system. The fact that courts back in English Chancery couldn't enjoin the king, I think, is not analogous or indicative of what courts can do in our system, where the king, quote unquote, the executive, is supposed to be bound by the law. And the court has the power to say what the law is. And so one would think that the court could say, this conduct is unlawful and you have to stop doing it.
Duh. That's my super technical legal argument. Like, duh. The courts should, of course, be able to say, Mr. King, I'm sorry, Mr. President, what you're doing is unconstitutional and you must stop. Because what is at stake is the daily violation of fundamental constitutional rights. And if we all got to go get a lawyer and we all got to run to court in each and every federal district, we are doomed. Then the Constitution is nothing but a set of suggestions that a king, excuse me, president, can either choose to observe or not on any given day. We deserve better. Folks, when we come back, we're going to talk about how to fill the gaps when the government fails your child's education, and what to do if these federal education cuts go through. Don't go anywhere. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Civic Media. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back. If you're rejoining us, my name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, I've been super excited all day to talk to my next two special guests. These are two moms who have been using hundreds of pairs of children's shoes to get the attention of our state legislators and let the public know how the underfunding of special education here in the state of Wisconsin is hurting all children. I'm super happy to be joined by Melissa Custer. She's from Grafton, mother of two neurodivergent children, as well as Tiffany Shano, who resides in Sheboygan and has three kids. Her youngest child is autistic. They met at a parent advocacy and leadership training through Family Voices Wisconsin and bonded over their shared experiences of getting their children the education and services that they need to be successful in school. They asked a lot of questions, did a lot of reading, and they figured out that our school funding formula is a little screwed up, especially when it comes to special education here in the state of Wisconsin. They've started a grassroots parent-led campaign to unite families across the political spectrum to help support our kids that have special needs. And let's now bring them onto the show. Welcome, Melissa. Welcome, Tiffany. Thank you so very much for being here, ladies. Your work is incredibly important. So I want to start with you, Tiffany. What made you start the Learn in My Shoes campaign, which, by the way, love the name. That's what it's about.
Thank you. So for us, it was really about being able to share what we had learned, and we'd heard so many stories from families just like ours, from parents who'd had so much difficulty just getting their children the education that they have rights to. And we wanted to share those stories, but we wanted to do it in a way that would grab attention, grab attention with our legislators. We wanted them to stop and to pay attention. And for families like ours, sometimes it can be difficult for them to be able to travel to the Capitol, it can be intimidating to reach out to their legislators. So we wanted to do it in a way that they would be able to participate and have their voices heard.
So important. Melissa, what was it like when you met Tiffany, and how did the idea germinate? Like, hey, we got to do our own thing. We got to start a new organization. We got to get the word out. How did that all come together?
Well, when I met Tiffany, I heard her telling her story in this room full of parent advocates. And I was like, I need to meet her. we need to help each other. And we started talking, and we just became close, and we send each other ridiculous memes every day.
I can tell you
it
one
is the
thing.
Foundation.
Ridiculous text message exchanges are the foundation and the lifeblood of all good friendships. I have met a couple of other incredible female electeds and advocates by noticing them in rooms saying what needed to be said as clear as it needed to be said, and saying, hey, I got to meet you because we're in this together. So tell me, can you make clear for our listeners, Tiffany, why and how the lack of adequate special education funding actually ends up harming all kids, even if your kid is like a super overperformer and college bound, all that good stuff? It's of a whole. And when we're not servicing the kids with special educational needs, it actually ends up hurting all of our students in all of our schools. Tell us how that comes together. Why is there a nexus there?
Absolutely. So right now in the state of Wisconsin, for every dollar that your school spends on special education, they're reimbursed about less than 30%.
So less than 30 cents, every dollar that a public school spends for special education, the state only returns to that school system. It's 29 cents on the dollar. I've also done my homework.
Yes.
So your school system has to make up that 71 cents from somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you can tell me where it comes from, Tiffany.
Yeah, that actually comes out of your school district's general education fund. So these districts are running a deficit, and they have to make up the deficit somehow. And that's how we end up with school districts who are on this referendum treadmill, I've heard it called.
Yes.
Where they're just going referendum to referendum, just trying to keep going.
And one of the disparities here, disparity is a fancy word for it's really unfair. One of the big pieces of the unfairness here is that we're asking our public school systems to find that 71 cents from their general fund, which means they have less money for, I don't know, things like lead abatement, if that might be an issue in your school system. They have less funding for arts education, sports, advanced coursework, and the general coursework and teacher compensation and social worker compensation and mental health. They have less for everything else. But if we turn to the way that our state funds special education for voucher schools, Melissa, it's quite different, isn't it? It's unfairly different, I might say.
Yes, it is. Voucher schools are reimbursed by at least 90%, some sufficient, I believe. Fair.
So no one misses this point. Special education funding in the state of Wisconsin for public schools, if a public school spends a dollar on SPED, I'm just going to use the acronym here on SPED, special education, the state gives the public school 29 cents. If you are a voucher school and you spend a dollar on SPED, the state gives you 90 cents back?
Yes.
Why are our special education kids in voucher systems entitled to more reimbursement than our special education kids in our actual public school system?
I don't know, because private schools are also not required to fulfill they're not bound by IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, where public schools are, and so they're required by law to fulfill these services, and they need to get that money from somewhere.
So let me
it's a fight.
Yeah, let me flesh this out. So a public school can't deny special education to any child. Voucher schools can. They're not bound by IDEA, a federal law. They're not bound to take all students, which if I extrapolate this out, Tiffany, let me be sure I'm going to get this straight. Yeah. The voucher school, if they deign to take a child that has special education needs, they can select which child with what special needs they want. They're not compelled to follow federal law, and yet the state is giving them 90 cents on the dollar for every dollar they spend, which means, again, extrapolating here, if I was running a voucher school, I would take the kids that have learning educational challenges that are, you know, the least costly, the least complicated, not the hardest kids to educate. And I'd leave for those public schools with their 29 cents on every dollar to struggle to fund the educational needs with public schools are legally required to provide with their 29 cents on the dollar. Mm-hmm. So you're creating this, it's sort of like doubling down on the unfairness because voucher schools don't have to follow federal law and take all children.
It gets worse. So if your child attends a voucher school and they are a student who requires special education and you decide that they cannot, or the school decides that they cannot be served properly in that voucher school, and you send your child back to your local public school district, that voucher school still keeps the money.
Keeps the money.
Yeah, that money doesn't follow your child back into public school special education. So it's a mess, right? And we're just asking for what's fair. We're asking for 60% special education reimbursement for public schools, and we should be asking for 90, but we're trying to be reasonable.
Now, Melissa, as I understand it, the state's nonpartisan legislative fiscal bureau has actually analyzed the need for these local referendums so that people, whereby residents say, yep, you can raise my taxes to fund my public school system. The LFB, nonpartisan, did an analysis to look at whether or not these extraordinary rates of local public school referendums would be necessary if we simply made the special education funding formula the same for voucher and public schools. Tell us more about what they found, Melissa.
That's actually a better question for Tiffany, to be honest.
That's fair. You guys can bounce the ball back and forth to one another. I'm not the only one that can do that. Tiffany, tell us a little bit about what the LFB found. The best answer to some questions is, I don't know. Go ask this person. I love that. Tiffany, tell us a little bit about the LFB.
They found that 1 in 5 referendums could have been avoided. And 271 of our 421 districts in Wisconsin went up for referendum over the past 2 years. Some multiple times.
Wow.
That's not acceptable.
Wow. 20% of this explosion in local referenda would be completely avoidable if we simply did what is right and fair and funded special education in public schools just like we do so in our voucher programs. That's stunning. Mm-hmm. Melissa, let me ask you a question. You were obviously compelled and persuaded by Tiffany's deep technical knowledge of this issue. I think a lot of people are really intimidated by that. They think, hey, I don't know enough of the specifics or details here. That means I can't get involved. If that's a fair description of how you may have felt at the outset of this, how did you get over that anxiety to yourself become an activist in this way and help elevate this issue alongside Tiffany?
I think that it just came to the point where it was more important than my fears. Mm. I is more important than that. So I just pushed myself and, you know, got more comfortable as time went on. We've been through some really difficult times with my older son in school. I'm actually homeschooling him because they were not able to support his high support needs. And I need to do whatever I can to stop it from happening to other families.
Melissa, I want to say you're my today hero, because what you said is the secret to unlocking the power of regular people. And that is that the issue becomes more important than our individual fear or discomfort. Mm-hmm. So you're my today hero. Thank you for being brave enough to do, like, that is a real thing. Like, I cannot tell you how many times I hear from folks like, well, I don't know all that much about it, so who am I to get involved? And I'm like, you're the exact, like, right person, regular person. Yeah, please, no, get involved.
No. public speaking is the last thing I ever thought I'd be doing. Getting involved in politics, literally the last things I ever thought I'd be doing.
Well, let me just say this, Melissa. Please keep public speaking. We need you. We appreciate you. Folks, that's Melissa Custer and Tiffany Shano, co-founders of Learn In My Shoes. You can find out more on their Facebook page. Also go to www.learninmyshoeswi.org. Ladies, thank you for your fearless advocacy. When we come back, I'll have closing thoughts on the day. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Stay safe out there.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome. If you're just joining us, my name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. A few more severe weather updates. The National Weather Service now reporting a tornado on the ground near Juneau, Wisconsin. Please be aware up there. We're also getting tornado warnings for Wood County as well as Marathon County. That is Wood County and Marathon County, with a touchdown being reported by the National Weather Service near Juneau, Wisconsin. Please stay safe, everybody. We're going to continue to break in with emergency weather warnings on your Civic Media Radio Network local affiliate. I will try to keep you updated as well here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Well, it has been an incredibly busy few days of news, as it now is here in our new abnormal, I'm going to call it. And I will pick up our discussion of the Supreme Court's arguments tomorrow with a special guest host for my first hour, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, host of Amicus, a legal brief from 9 to 11 a.m. on Saturday mornings, Jim Santel, my friend and yours. We're going to dig back in. I've gotten a number of questions over the chat about those Supreme Court arguments. We will revisit with Jim Santel, likely for the goodly portion of that first hour. We're also going to touch on tomorrow this little phenomena you may have heard about, that people are sending pizzas to federal court judges, to their residences. No, they're not trying to feed judges. They're trying to scare the bejiggers out of them by telling the judges not so subtly that I know where you live. This is quite appalling. We'll dig into that as well with former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, Jim Santel, tomorrow. But as I discussed at length yesterday on our program, the big action out of Washington, D.C. this week, in addition to the Supreme Court's arguments, has been the House Budget Reconciliation Bill moving through Ways and Means. Again, what does it boil down to? Well, middle class and working poor people will be sicker, live shorter lives, have less money, pay more for stuff, and generally live in an extended state of fear and anxiety for the foreseeable future, all to do what? Give 100 billionaires and mega corporations tax cuts. Yes, that's right, my friends. And surprisingly enough, ladies and gentlemen, Ron Johnson has stumbled his way to clear-throated opposition. Not, ladies and gentlemen, because Ron Johnson wants to support hungry families by expanding SNAP, not because he wants to expand Medicaid coverage to ensure that every child has health coverage and goes to school both fed and healthy for learning. No, not for any of those reasons. Because Ron Johnson fancies himself quite the budget hawk. Let's take a listen to Ron Johnson on Fox Business today, Cut 31.
Can you see yourself voting for this big, beautiful bill at all?
Not in the current structure, no. Yeah, I refuse to vote for something that's going to actually increase the deficits, exacerbate the problem from the current situation. Again, we shouldn't be talking about this right now. We should have been doing all the work, like I say, multi-step process. We'd already have the border funding, we'd have defense, we'd have $850 billion of real savings banked already. Plus, we could have extended current tax law, taken tax law increase off the table. We could have had all that done, but unfortunately, decisions were made to do one big, beautiful bill. It's not beautiful. I'm sorry. It's not a big, beautiful bill. That's called rhetoric.
There's
mislabeling.
Okay, just like Jacob, can we play just the front end of that cut one more time? Let's take a look, and I'm going to cut you off right at the money line. Jacob, let's take it one more time.
Can you see yourself voting for this big, beautiful bill at all?
Not in the current structure, no. Yeah, I refuse to vote for something that's going to actually increase the deficits.
Okay, did Ron Johnson just say that he is going to refuse to vote for something if it increases the deficits? Because, ladies and gentlemen, let's all remind ourselves, shall we, together? Did Ron Johnson vote for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 that blew up the deficit by trillions of dollars? Wait. From the back of the class, I think I can hear you there. Yes, in fact, he did. Voted with every single Republican in the Senate in 2017 to pass the first version of this garbage, which also gave tax cuts to 100 billionaires and mega corporations and exploded the deficit. But now it's a bridge too far. Do you think Ron Johnson might be finding his way to this deficit hawkishness because he might be worried about his reelection? I don't know. But ladies and gentlemen, I'm just going to suggest to you that the Ron Johnsons of the world don't really care about you. They're using this traditional deficit hawkishness to simply protect their reelection prospects. In nearly every single other circumstance, when it comes to, for example, tax credits or tax write-offs that actually help middle-class Americans, you know, like the child tax credit, like the state and local tax credit. He opposes all those things. But if you want Ron Johnson to go on at length, and I mean at length, about all of the tax dodges, loopholes, refunds, and credits that big businesses and 100 millionaires like Ron Johnson gets, he's all for those. Don't believe the Rojo hype. He ain't out for you. He's out for his own bottom line. That's going to do it for me today. Stay tuned on Civic Media. Pete Chihuahua with Nightlights up next. We'll keep you coming and covered with our breaking weather updates. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.